So our guest today is Rabbi Zalman. I've never been quite straight. Is it Teichtel? Teichtel. Okay. Who has been in Lawrence, I guess, for a couple of years now, with the Chabad Lubavitch movement within Judaism, and has, by all accounts, brought a real burst of energy to Jewish life in Lawrence. So I'm kind of interested in finding out what it's like jumping from New York City to the heartland, as we like to think of it. So anyway, we'll proceed with down that line and see what we can find out. Just to be clear about what we're doing, we are trying to turn this into a website of just a real mosaic of all kinds of Kansas religious experiences, so this will be posted along with the other things. So I guess what we're trying to do is kind of combine your personal story with the larger concerns of the community that you've lived in and so forth. And so, you know, something about your background, your childhood, and your the process by which you came to Kansas and so forth. But it's pretty much up to you. You can go wherever you like with it, and I know you're pretty good at storytelling and things like that. So
good thing the button has a click when the tape's over. How many hours do I have?
Well, we're going to stop you after about an hour or so.
No, I'm just kidding. We'll keep it brief. So my name is Zalman. I moved from small town Brooklyn to big city Lawrence. It's hard to speak to a crowd when you don't know who you're talking to. I don't know how many of you are from the Midwest or any of you from the East Coast. Okay, great.
There's pretty much all Midwesterners, right?
Wonderful.
Yeah.
So just go a little bit background. I grew up in a small community within Brooklyn, known as Crown Heights. It's a very unique community in the sense that it's a real blend of the Jewish people and African Americans who live together, not only side by side, but literally house. Integrated with each other. The stores on the avenue are really a representation of the Jewish community, the Jewish culture, along with the African-American culture. And as long as I remember growing up there, besides very, very unique situations, there's been a great friendship, and that's something which helped me grow up in a sense of realizing how it's all of us together that make the world a beautiful place that it is. So I grew up in a community where it's one of the large families. I say large, I mean really large. I have 12 siblings. My wife has 11 siblings. So although there's only a few thousand families, but that automatically means thousands and thousands of people, lots of little children running around. That's where I grew up. In Brooklyn, some of you may be familiar that Brooklyn is well known in the fact that there's a number of communities there that are very, very Hasidic. What does Hasidic mean? Generally, if you walk down the street and you meet somebody who shows some kind of sign of being a Jew, whether it's a skull cap, known as a kippah, whether it's a beard, that means that this person, this individual, perhaps is more active, more proactive in expressing the Judaism. Hasids, also known as Hasidim, are unique in the sense not only we wear a kippah, but a lot of times we wear black hats, black coats, sometimes we call them men in black. And that's unique about Brooklyn, that there's a number of communities where there's literally thousands of families that all belong to the Hasidic sect within Judaism. And that's where I grew up. What brings me to Lawrence, Kansas? In a real nutshell, what's unique about the movement that I am affiliated with, it's called Chabad, which is C-H-A-B-A-D. And this movement is unique that on one hand, its philosophies and its beliefs and its lifestyle is rooted very deep. It's been the same for hundreds of years. And that hasn't changed a bit. On the other hand, it's the only Hasidic movement that embraces the need to merge the gap between what some may call religion, spirituality, and the physical secular society. So while other Hasidic communities are more insular in the sense that they stick within their own community. So when you get married, you move a block away from your parents, and that's where your children live, and you basically stick together. The movement that I'm affiliated with is founded upon the belief that the reason why we're in this world is because we have a mandate, and that is to do whatever we can to make this world a better place, wherever that may be. And therefore, in my education, I was encouraged that it's not enough just to stay in Brooklyn, but we have this passion to move out to other communities where we can perhaps contribute to spiritual life. And that's how I ended up in Lawrence, Kansas a couple of years ago, where my wife and I, after we got married, we both had this passion to move out there. And sure enough, we found Lawrence, which is a story to itself, and we moved here 4 years ago. So that's briefly a little background about our movement. I only touched upon it very, very superficially. Really, the Hasidic movement that I belong to is a very lengthy topic. It could be a course to itself. And the reason for that is because there's a very deep philosophy connected to this idea. And it's called the philosophy of Chabad. There's hundreds of books, scholarly books written by many rabbis throughout the past 300 years since this movement has been founded, a little over 300 years ago. And these scholarly works talk a little more about, at great length, about the concept that I just touched upon briefly. About this idea that we view the responsibility of every individual to feel for society at large. It's not enough for a person to say, I am comfortable where I am. Rather, there's a responsibility within every single individual, regardless of how far you can reach, to make a difference. That's in a nutshell.
Okay.
Now, if there's anything, for me it's easier to talk when there's dialogue. If there's any questions or conversation, please bring that up. Or if there's anything specific you would like to focus on.
Okay.
You mentioned something about how do I view Kansas in the picture,
sure, yeah,
in that tradition. I'll tell you, it's fascinating that we're having this talk today. Because this morning I had a movie experience. I spent some time with the governor of Kansas doing what? Wasn't budget planning. I told him I'm in sales, not in management. Can't help with the budget. What would I do? What's a rabbi doing in the state capital with the governor of Kansas? If there was New York, or you know, someone may say, all right, they're probably doing something Jewish. It makes sense. But believe it or not, this morning I was in the state capital with the governor lighting a menorah for the holiday of Hanukkah. Something which never happened before, actually, in the state capital. And I was telling the governor that I'm so moved to be here today, because this really exemplifies and highlights the uniqueness of the Midwest, in the sense that back east, people don't have that sensitivity, don't have that respect and awe from religion. As I was telling someone today, the governor's aide, that back in New York, people don't have the time to think about what really matters. Because the whole mentality is that everyone's rushing, 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 rushing. You ever went to New York City? Who's been to New York? You ever went on the subway? It's a horrible experience. You need to recover afterwards. No one even looks at you. Everyone's, all people care about is getting to the next stop. And there's something unique about the mentality in the Midwest and what I found in Kansas is that people are extremely focused on what really matters in life. And it's not a contradiction, even if you're in a rush, to stop in the street and say hello to somebody. Smile to a child, or reach out to someone in need. And this ties in as well to religion. People in other places don't perhaps have that sensitivity to realize that there's a higher purpose to life. There's something beyond rushing to the next thing. And that's something which I have found personally in Kansas, something unique, that people are willing to hear, to listen, to grow. People have an interest, people have a thirst, and most importantly, people have a respect for what really matters. And that's the feeling I had this morning. And on the way here, I was thinking about, you know, what could we talk about? And I remember the email you sent me about the purpose of this conversation. And I thought, how befitting that this morning I had an experience which really highlights so much this idea of how really just walking through the Capitol with the menorah and seeing everybody's excitement and having a Jewish celebration in the Capitol. That's something which I think brings the point even stronger, that I have found, since I moved to Kansas, tremendous respect and interest and just a general sense of, I'm not sure what the right word would be, help me out.
Well, pluralism or...
Pluralism and diversity and acceptance.
Uh-huh. And that's, I wonder, do you have a sense, this is beyond Kansas, do you have a sense the whole country is moving somewhat in that direction? I mean, real anti-Semitism is not ancient history, and Kansas has had plenty of it.
You think maybe we are? I think that any anti-Semitism that I've encountered in Kansas has been lack of knowledge. I could tell you a story that I'm only saying this to you just to highlight. I don't know where you are from. Some of you may be able to relate to this, but I was once in a gas station. I travel a lot throughout Kansas. Officially, my territory, so to say, where we have three other centers in the state of Kansas. And we divide up. And I officially have what's called, all the way to Colorado, much of what you want to call it, Western Kansas. And I travel a lot to outlying communities where I meet different people of the Jewish faith, who perhaps we can help them out in any way. And I was once in a gas station in the middle of nowhere in Kansas. And when I say middle of nowhere, I mean a place where I'm from New York. So when I go to a gas station, I always like asking people how many people live in this town, just to get an idea. And this was really some very, very small place. And I went into this gas station and had a nice conversation with the person behind the counter. Very friendly, very kind. But the person had was a teenager. And he had a very innocent question. And he meant it in all sincerity. He wanted to know, where are my horns?
Your horns?
In all sincerity.
Wow.
Whoa. So I said, I smiled as I left them in the trunk. And I said, let me talk to you a little bit. And I spoke to him. And he never met a Jewish person before in his life, ever. All he knew was maybe a film that he'd seen or something he's read.
And the you're talking devil's horns.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Michelangelo, it has a basis because of the famous painting.
Moses. Yeah. But that's a mistranslation.
100%. 100%. But, you know, the art of Hollywood is that they could portray anything and make you think it's it, you know? And my mistake is so just to show you how he didn't mean anything bad at all. And I had no hard feelings. It was just a matter of knowledge, education. And that's the only sense of what one may call antisemitism that I've encountered in the state of Kansas. And it was really just people that never met a Jew before. And that's something which may be a new experience. If someone comes from a small town with aren't many Jewish people, it's usually curiosity. It's not necessarily...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead. Oh, I just... you said having a question would help you. Is this just
sure.
not
me right
interrupt?
Right at all. I'm from New York. The way we talk is by interrupting.
just following on that note, I suppose Nelson and Westerners begin to think of New York or Brooklyn, you know, as a very cosmopolitan area, very diverse ethnically, you know, in many respects. And we often tend to even stereotype ourselves as being kind of narrow-minded, you know, backwater, you know, we're Midwesterners, whatever, you know. So with that on that being the single account of what you might, you know, call anti-Semitism, have you encountered anti-Semitism in any respect in Brooklyn throughout your life? That they might be comparable or more interesting. Is there another example of that?
I have encountered it, and in Brooklyn it was different means. It was slurs, it was shouts, it was name-calling. Maybe in not the best neighborhood. It wasn't an innocent question. It was, of course, it also has to do with the education they received and the upbringing those people grew up in, but it definitely wasn't that same sense of innocence.
So do you feel that there is a... So you would contrast the general ambiance or cultural circumstances of the Midwest, or Kansas specifically, with that of Brooklyn as being slightly more open?
Well, it's hard to generalize. This is my personal journey has been that, yes, people in Kansas have been more welcoming, interested, and accepting. I see that in my line of work. I interact with people from all different backgrounds and doing different whether it's programs or events, and I've always encountered a tremendous amount of respect and interest. How can we help? Now, it could be there's different theories about that. You know, I guess the community is smaller in Kansas, so there's more of a, you know, New York is so many, so it's not the same attitude. But this is just my personal experience.
There's uninformed, but then there's misinformed. So someone told him, or he learned that.
Sure.
And that's a little alarming.
In today's day and age, people get that information from all kinds of places. So, for all we know, it could be the internet, which came from far away from small town Kansas.
Maybe like Fox News.
Yep. I tend not to, in order to alienate anybody, I tend not to give examples, but that may be as well. You know, it's very possible someone sitting in a small town where they're very supportive of the Jewish people. But their information is not being fed from their teacher. It's being fed from somewhere online or somewhere else. I work with students most of the time, which is a fun part of my job. And I've I would say I never had this personally, but I've had students that have been suffered a little bit or been influenced by this misinformation. So in other words, there have been students that I've been involved with, Jewish students that came to me for guidance, had to deal with a situation where they're getting unpleasant remarks. Again, maybe not out of hate, but out of misinformation.
Can you say that? As long as it doesn't get, you know, it can get very out of hand, as we know. But it normally says more about them, or it says everything about them, nothing about you.
100%. But sometimes, as a college student, imagine you get a note under your door. You're saying something about who you are, about your ethnicity, about your culture.
Like that movie, Class Ties?
Right. Exactly. So for me, I was able to rise above it, and I was like, I said, let's have a coffee together. We'll sit down and we'll talk about it. But sometimes when you're in the receiving end, it's hard to take it that way. And I would mention that the university here has a tremendous respect for diversity. They'll do whatever they can. In fact, in that situation, they treated it very, very harshly. And there was no two ways about it. You know, when such a thing happens, they just deal with it very, very seriously.
Can you say something about, in your childhood growing up, your education? The Chabad movement has its own schools, right? So you didn't go to public school.
Correct.
And all that. Can you describe what that was like?
Sure. Our education, the reason why we don't go to public school is because a very large component of our education is a Jewish education. In fact, when we start off our day, for the first 4 hours of the day, strictly Judaic studies from first grade, or grade one. So from the beginning, we divide the day in half where we learn, of course, all the secular subjects, the regular subjects, but the primary focus in the first part of the day is Judaic studies. And that's why we have private schools, our own network, where all the local students, local children study in the same school. Our system also works different, that when we reach high school, the class load is less than perhaps in an average high school. We do just enough, of course, to get the diploma and go through the basic education. But we do increase our hours tremendously. And that's called yeshiva. That's the term used, which is Y-E-S-H-I-V-A. From ninth grade and on, we change our hours. And we study from 7:30 in the morning till 9 o'clock at night, with some breaks throughout the day. And the reason why we have so many hours is because we have to make up for the hours that we spend studying other subjects, to study Talmud, Jewish law, Jewish philosophy. When we finish high school, instead of going, you have a choice, you can go to college, but in my situation, and this is what hundreds of my peers do, we go instead to a yeshiva, which is called an intense Talmudic seminary, where we study basically from 7 in the morning to 11 at night, strictly Judaic subjects. Everything pertaining to Judaism, whether it's law, whether it's philosophy, history, whatever it may be. And as the years go on, it intensifies. So by the time you're 20 years old, you're increasing in the hours, and you're increasing in the intensity. There's no breaks, like spring break, fall break, summer break. You take off here and there. Basically, 12 months a year, you're studying from 7:30 in the morning to 9:10 at night. And at the end of 21, 22, if you choose to be a rabbi, that's when you add 2 more years to actually get your ordination. Something very unique, which is very, very different in our model of education, that we don't study for a degree. We don't get a degree for all those years that we study in yeshiva. So technically, someone could study for 7, 8 years in yeshiva. And besides their high school diploma, of course, they do not have to get a degree. If you decide not to add that extra year or two, you could spend 7, 8 years studying Judaism without actually getting a degree. And that says something very, very meaningful about the way we view our studies. That unlike when you go to college, some people say, I go to college, it's a means to an end. You know, the end is to get the degree. The proper approach probably is that you go to college to become a well-rounded, educated person. And that's why a lot of the classes and coursework we take may not necessarily directly relate to our degree, but it's something important to be an educated person. We view our Jewish studies as well the same way, that we're not studying the Torah in order for a degree, it's not a means to an end, but we feel that what gives meaning in our life is when we simply sit for hours and hours and study Torah. That is an end to itself. And that's why we spent so many years studying the Torah, regardless if it's going to lead to a degree or not. Personally, even though I grew up in Brooklyn, there's many yeshivas all over the world that are very well known. So many times we travel. I spent 3 years in Israel and 2 years in Paris. It's a very well-known yeshiva, some of the seminaries. Although there's many of them in Brooklyn, just some of them that are particularly well-known for certain things. And that's what I gravitated towards. But if you go, for example, to Israel, there's hundreds, if not thousands, of such institutions where you have hundreds of people that all they're doing all day is studying what's known as the Torah, which is the Bible and its teachings.
Does all that studying raise more questions, or does it answer more questions?
It's a great question. In Judaism, the most important thing is a question. And the only bad question is the one not asked. So, 100% right. It's all about questions. The reason why we study the same thing over and over again. In fact, in Jewish tradition, we take the Torah, which is the Bible, and every week we read another portion. At the end of the year, which is usually in October time, we celebrate the conclusion of the cycle. And then we start again. They've been doing this for thousands of years. So when I'm studying this week, for this Sabbath, I just studied a year ago. But I'm still doing it again and again and again. And the reason for that is because, as you mentioned, every time you study, you get a deeper understanding, a deeper layer, and a deeper question, which in turn leads to more understanding and more questions. The Talmud said that the Torah, the Bible, is like a river, like a sea. It's endless. All you can take, if you take a drop, you still have a lot more to go.
And you stay together, basically, you have a few different branches of Judaism, whereas with Protestantism, we have more types of Baptists than France has cheese.
Right.
Because they split. If they disagree, they go.
Right. There are some core differences in different sects within Judaism, as far as beliefs, but I don't believe the differences are that vast.
Is there any point where in your education or on completing all of these Talmudic studies studies of the Torah or various texts and everything, is there ever a point where you're encouraged or required to take a more what we would consider liberal arts education, like maybe the equivalent of like an associate's or bachelor's degree or something? As you said, become more well-rounded. Is there ever a point where you're...
That's a great question. The answer is definitely so, and it's up to each individual. So in my graduating class of high school, there was different. While I was studying in yeshiva, because that's the path I chose, parallel to that, I have many friends that went to study in the liberal arts. You get a liberal arts degree or study in universities across the country. So without a doubt, you know, parallel to my growth in my field, there's others that focus in other areas as well. So there is a minimal amount of energy that we all invest in Torah study. And there's a certain point that we definitely branch off. I always had this passion to be a rabbi. So I knew that for me, I'm going to have to go through all these years. But you touched upon more of a broader question about... it is true that there's a larger percentage in my community that pursues a rabbinic degree. And that ties into a separate conversation about what's the reason for that. And a lot of it is simply that's the upbringing that we get. And that's the motivation, the passion we have. But there are many individuals in my community that definitely went on to college, got a degree in other areas. There's many professionals, there's lawyers, there's doctors, there's accountants, there's all kinds of professions, artists, musicians in my community as well, that pursued their careers.
Do you feel that with, I would imagine that just like, you know, with anybody, you probably get to an age, you know, in middle school or high school, that, you know, there might be some resistance just because of rebellion or whatever. I mean, because there's so much emphasis on education, do you still, you know, face that problem or how is that?
Definitely so, definitely. Just definitely those people, those individuals. And that's where they make different choices. And the parents are always supportive. See, it's not a contradiction. Tying to what I spoke earlier on, there are some movements within the Hasidic groups that are very insular. And the way they shun an academic career or something, or other professions beyond something, you know, sticking to the yeshiva program till the end. And they might not be as supportive, perhaps, if someone in the family chooses otherwise. I grew up in a community where there is a very big focus on the merge of both societies. So it is definitely very common that you stick to your religious lifestyle, but you still do not take the path of studying in yeshiva for so many years. Definitely does exist. You have some people that grew up in my community that dropped the whole religious thing too. Yeah, they couldn't adapt to that lifestyle. And that happens as well. Especially if you have large families. You know, you have a lot of different children. Everyone's different. Some people in the same family. You can have some people that are rabbis and some that are professionals and some that totally left the whole religion.
Well, to pursue the matter of education, okay, so you grew up in Crown Heights. That's pretty easy. Right. Yeshiva's available and all. So what about your kids? How are they going to get that equivalent education? I mean, are you doing it personally?
That's a great question. The challenge begins very, very early in life because, as mentioned, our kids don't go to public school already from first grade from the beginning. In fact, even when they go to pre-K, they go to specifically a Jewish school because we believe that a child is like a tree. When you plant a tree, if the seeds or if the roots are a little bit crooked, the whole tree is going to be crooked. Meaning that we don't want that they should go to public school where it may be a great school, but there's no Jewish knowledge, which I understand. I respect that. But the fact is that I want my children to discover Judaism from when they're very young. If I wait until they're 10 years old, at that point they may already not have the same appreciation and may not be at the same stage that they're ready to grow into this Judaism. So that's why from the beginning we put our kids in private schools. And that's the reason why usually you don't find a religious Jew like me living in Kansas. The only time you'll find a rabbi who's religious living in a Jewish in a community where there is no Jewish infrastructure is if they're a Chabad rabbi. And there's over 4,000 centers around the world that are Chabad. And these centers are everywhere and anywhere. I have a friend in Montana. I have a friend in Cancun, Mexico. I have a friend in Siberia. I have a brother in Germany. I have a brother in Champaign, Illinois, at U of I, where there's also a very small Jewish community. So really, it's very unique to find a religious Jew who lives in such a community where you don't have kosher food. Do you know what that is? You know, in New York, everywhere you go, there's kosher food. I only eat kosher food. So that means that in Canada, I can't really find kosher meat or kosher chicken. It means that I need 4 freezers and I have everything shipped in. I don't have a synagogue where I can go pray 3 times a day. In Brooklyn, where I grew up, 3 times a day you would go to synagogue, you would meet probably 100, 200 of your friends, and you would pray together. And here, I'm the only person praying 3 times a day in 100-mile radius. Education, there is no Jewish school in Lawrence for my children. So really, these are challenges that's the reason why you don't find a religious Jew living out in these communities, besides the Chabad rabbi. And the way we handle those challenges, right now, actually, I take my kids, there's a Jewish day school in Kansas City. I take my kids there, but that might be tough as they grow older. It's a little bit of a commute. I'm better off than my brother in Champaign, Illinois. The closest Jewish school is 3 hours away, which is obviously not a practical commute. Yeah. It's interesting. We have an online school. It's called Chabad Online School, just for the Chabad rabbis and their families who live in the middle of nowhere. So I have a nephew in Champaign that he has classmates from all over the country. My nephew in Germany tells me that my best friend lives in Belgium because he goes to online school for the past 6 years. And when you go to this online school, it's based in New York, and you have teachers that teach their children from all over, and they all have one thing in common, that they all don't have a school to go to. So they interact. And once a year, we have a conference in November where all the dads get together and the moms and the kids. And the kids have their own conference, and they get to meet their friends and meet their teachers. Just happened 2 weeks ago. In fact, you could Google it. It's a fascinating thing. It's called the World's Largest Rabbi Picture. They take a picture with over 4,000 rabbis in front of Chabad headquarters. And they have to block up the big parkway to do that. And the photographer always says, "Hey, rabbi, move to the right." But it's usually a picture which turns a lot of heads because that's a lot of people from all over the world that get together. And most importantly, education starts at home. So, I mean, all of you could relate to this, I'm sure. Think about, make a list of who had the greatest impact in you in your life. Top 5 people. chances are, or top three people, chances are that as much as you have many great teachers, one of those three people would be one of your parents, hopefully. Best case scenario, both parents. Really, education starts at home. So my children, they know that they have a different lifestyle than many of the children they know in town. And their joy in the Jewish education really starts at home, even more than I had in Brooklyn, because we have to make up and compensate for what they're missing in a Jewish education.
You mentioned the challenges of kosher diet. Can you say a little more about that?
So what do you guys know about kosher? What makes food kosher?
The way that the animal is killed, the way it's handled, mixing different foods, not can't mix meat or dairy.
Lead.
Know your stuff. Very nice. And, of course, the ingredients. Some foods are kosher, some aren't. Many people think that what makes food kosher is a blessing. Someone comes in, the rabbi comes and gives a blessing. Abracadabra, it's kosher. Only kosher food would be a lot cheaper if that was the case. Kosher is like those three components. Number one, most importantly, certain foods are kosher, certain foods are not kosher. There's guidelines, how we know what's kosher and what's not kosher. If it's animals, they have to have certain symptoms. You know, if it's fish, they have to have fins and scales, etc. In addition to that, even those animals that may be kosher, we only eat them if they're slaughtered properly, in a very humane way. And in addition to that, they need to be cleaned in a way that we don't taste any of their blood. Blood is not kosher. As far as ingredients are concerned, we don't need any insects, we don't need any... most of the fish out there we don't eat. And there's many other different criterias. But practically speaking, if you are a vegetarian, it's much easier to keep kosher. But even then, if you pick up a can or any item in the grocery store, you look at the ingredients, there's many, many ingredients you have no idea what it's talking about. Flavor, food coloring, chemical, even beyond that. There's also many ingredients that are not listed on the ingredient list according to the requirements. So how do you know if something's kosher or not? The only way you know is if there's a kosher symbol. And I'm involved a little bit in kosher. And I do some kosher in some plants, and I could just tell you that, for example, here in Lawrence, right outside of Lawrence, is a huge plant called ICL, which actually stands for Israel Chemical Laboratory. It's fascinating. Oh, it's based in Israel. But they actually make, when you open a can of Pepsi, and you have that fizz, they make the chemicals. They give it that effect. Now, you would think, what's the big deal, right? Well, that needs to be kosher. Because there are certain chemicals that are derived from certain elements that are not kosher. So you look at a can of Pepsi, you would think that you have to... And that's how extensive kosher food actually is. So when you go shopping today, thank God, 80% of the items in the grocery store are kosher. Just look for an OU or an OK, one of those symbols. So that's quite simple. But when it comes to dairy products, it's much more of a challenge. When it comes to meat and chicken, that's where it's a challenge. Because in Kansas, there's no kosher slaughtering operation going on. And if it is happening somewhere else, no one's going to ship to Kansas because there isn't enough clientele. So thankfully, in recent years, there's been a growth, and there is one store in Overland Park that carries some kosher chicken. It's very expensive because of the fact that they get smaller shipments. There's actually, believe it or not, there's a kosher Subway. There's only eight in the entire world, and there's one in Kansas City. Don't ask me why. I mean, I'm happy.
Is everything there kosher in the whole place?
Everything there is kosher in the kosher Subway.
So they don't.
It's the only place I eat out of my home.
So they don't have pepperoni or
no pepperoni. They have soy-based pepperoni.
Huh.
Where is that?
It's at Lamar and College. It's right. If you I don't know if you guys have ever been to Overland Park. There's a big convention center, Overland Park Convention Center. It's right across the street. Huh. Now I'll be honest with you. You can find a $5 foot long. It's $10.99 or $11.99, but. It definitely tastes different. You can try it out. The reason why it's here is because there's a family that wants to invest in it. It's their thing. But just that just gives you an idea. And beyond that, if you want to have kosher chicken or kosher meat, you have to get it chipped in.
Is the there used to be a kosher deli out in the Overland Park area? Is that
so? There's now, thank God, there's a kosher deli. It closed for a while, and now there's a new one opened up a couple of years. It's in the Hen House at 119th and Row, and they have a fairly large kosher section. But everything is relative. You know, I was just in New York 2 weeks ago, and you walk into this huge supermarket the size of Dillon's, and everything is kosher. So it's quite a different world.
So you accept the U level of certification, I think you're saying, right? But there's some people who don't. Some are stricter than that.
I am stricter for meat and chicken. Wine, kosher wine is a challenge.
What about fresh fruit and vegetables? Do you worry about certification on those?
Fresh fruit and vegetables are all kosher.
That's what I thought.
But we don't need any bugs or insects, so you have to check. We have to wash. We wash all our lettuce, all our strawberries, all our broccoli extensively. We wash it with soap. We wash with water. Because in Jewish tradition, if we eat a piece of lettuce and it has bugs, that's against our law.
What would happen if you did accidentally? What?
Lightning strikes you.
No,
what happens is you learn from your mistakes.
But I mean, is there any kind of ritual cleansing or something that...
The ritual cleansing is to try to make a resolution to improve in this specific area. So usually it doesn't happen intentionally. Mm-hmm. And if it does, then you just make up for it.
Okay.
Well, and not know too much about microbiology.
It's some people, I'll be honest, some people don't eat strawberries. There are many religious Jews that don't eat strawberries at all. Because that's one of the most hardest fruits, and broccoli as well. So you're right. I mean, it's a challenge. In fact, there's an institution in Israel that all they do is study the bugs, and they have notices that go out letting everyone know which season, which vegetables are worse, what to look out for.
But bugs go way down.
Okay. I agree with you. That's why I'm saying that when we make a salad, we put a lot of work into that salad. If you go to a kosher hotel or a kosher restaurant in New York City, there's an extra fee. Everything costs more money because there's someone in the kitchen checking every single lettuce. Now, there are in Israel there are certain greenhouses that the lettuce grows in a very safe environment, and you could actually buy prepackaged lettuce that officially has a stamp on it. There's no legs, no bugs, and that's obviously a lot more expensive. You obviously can't find it in Kansas.
But you know what I'm saying is, what level of size do we...
That's a good question. You do what you can. You know, obviously, if you can't see it, you're exempt. There's nothing you can do about it.
Okay. All right. I don't want to nitpick. I just...
See the pocket.
Yeah.
Do you have to use a special soap to clean everything with?
There is a special spray. But the truth is, as long as you wash it very well, you can use regular soap as well. But there is a special spray. It's called a kosher bug spray. That's safe on the food.
Let me shift a little bit and ask about marriage and marriage practices. You're married. For one thing, I'm curious, do you get married? You had all this education. Were you married before that was finished? Or... Do they prefer that you not be married? Yes, because you could stay obviously more focused on that.
Right. We have a tradition that after we get married, we stay another year and study before you actually. And it's called what they call a postgraduate school where you study for a year, they support you, they give you a monthly stipend because now you're married and you got to support yourself. And all the years you're in yeshiva, you live in their campus, and they support you. But now when you're married, they pay for you a monthly stipend for 12 months, and you study. And then after that year, that's when you decide if you want to follow your profession, whatever it may be.
And I believe, is it in some Hasidic communities, I don't know about Chabad, but I think in many of them, that marriage is a match, right, rather than...
Okay, so you just opened up a can of worms.
Yeah, okay.
But how much more time
we have to go for
okay.
Half an hour if we have to. Okay. Or what's available for you?
This also may be something very new to some of you, how we are dating. Any of you familiar beyond what you've seen in the movies, which was always a misrepresented. Okay. Believe it or not, when I grew up, I had minimal interaction with people of the opposite sex. And the reason for that is because in my community, there was a strong emphasis on focus on your studies and your self-growth, and you could easily be distracted when you're in an environment which is very deeply engaged with members of the opposite sex. So when high school, just imagine this, I went to an all-male high school. Not only that, out of the classroom setting, there was minimal interaction. I didn't have a girlfriend growing up. I had a lot of sisters, but no girlfriend. So our interaction with boys and girls mingling together, the social scene in my community, didn't really happen. So what happens when you're ready to get married? So how did all that happen? How did it start? So usually, in my community, it's usually when you're around 22, 23, somewhere between 22 and 25. And there's no rules in the game. That's very important to understand. There are no rules. If anyone wants to lead a different lifestyle, the option is there. But this is not the general, the way it works. When you're ready to get married, what does it mean you're ready to get married? How do you know when you're ready to get married? Most people feel you're ready to get married when you have enough money in the bank account. That's the way it works in society. You have a secure job, you can support a family, maybe now I'm ready. If I have to wait till I'm 40, that's what I'll do. My community, it had nothing to do with money at all. The emphasis was, are you mature enough? Are you ready? Is your identity solidified enough that you could now connect with another identity? Do you know who you are before you want to connect with somebody else? And that's really what it's about. So in my case, I was 22 years old, and I felt, with the guidance of my mentors, my teachers, and my parents, that I'm ready. I feel that I know who I am, that's what I thought at the time, and I'm ready to get married. So here comes the problem. I never dated before. Not only that, you know, where do I start from? It's not like I have 1,000 Facebook friends and they're all waiting for me. So, I don't go ahead. And even more importantly, we don't date for fun. We date for marriage. Now, you can date as long as you need. But as long as it's for a purpose, for marriage, not for fun. Therefore, when you begin, how do you start? So the way it works is that there are people which are called matchmakers. Now, what does that mean? That means that there are people in the community that know a lot of people. And they find it their duty to know everybody. When I say no, it means they know who has a child this age and what kind of personality that person is. And they have these amazing minds. They keep it all on track. Now, it's not so far-fetched because everyone in this room knows a lot of different people. So they happen to know a lot of people. They also have to have a good memory. And they remember things. And they put things together. So in many situations, what happened maybe is a matchmaker would say, hey, you know, I know you a little bit. I know your personality. I know someone who actually has a similar personality. Someone I think you'll connect with quite well. So understand, this is very different than meeting someone at a bar. Because what's happening here is that before the dating even begins, you make sure that you have something in common. But you still don't date. You actually find out about each other. You get references. Okay? So let's say Jake is told, you know, this wonderful, wonderful person, her name is Sarah. She fits your personality so great. Okay, sounds nice. I think, you know, okay, give me some references, please. So now, without Jake and Sarah interacting, the matchmaker is in the middle, gives Sarah some references about Jake, gives Jake some references about Sarah, and then Jake goes, and or he does it himself, or people help him, his parents or friends, and they do a series of phone calls. Hi, do you know Sarah? Can you tell me about her? What's her personality? And they do a lot of research. And by the time they meet, Jake and Sarah go out the first time on a date, they know about each other more than a couple dating for a year, perhaps, in today's society. Now, when they date, so the first few times, you get to know each other, you cuddle with each other, but it's very much, you know, it's not, I mean, there is, of course, the play of emotion. It's not just strictly a business meeting, a checklist, but the focus pretty much is on getting to know each other. And by the time you go out 2, 3, 4, 5 times, 10 times, or 20 times, whatever it is, you get to know about who you really are. And you have very deep, meaningful conversations about what you want from yourself, what do you want from your life, do you want children, how many children do you want to have, where do you want to live, you know, how would you bring up your children. You talk about issues that will happen in 40 years from now, because you plan on getting married forever. Now, in my case, it was a little different, because I have a younger sister who studied abroad for a year in Australia, and she made a very good friend in her study program, and she came back from Australia and drove me nuts for 6 months, until I said, all right, and then we met through my sister, so to say, but we went through the same process. Before my wife and I met the first time, we knew a lot about each other. We knew that we're very similar. We knew what our differences are. We knew all about our weaknesses, to the extent that people know. And when we dated, the focus was on getting to know each other. And that leads to something else that may be very shocking. In our community, we also don't actually have any physical interaction. So not only we don't have intimate relations, my wife and I, when we dated, we didn't even touch our fingers. So imagine spending hundreds of hours with someone at your side without touching that person.
You end up with 12 or 11 kids.
What?
When you can.
No, not at all. On the contrary, it takes the whole... I don't want to get too much into marriage and relationships here. It's not a topic of the talk. But you got it wrong. Because on the contrary, when you were so intimate before you got married, it has so much less meaning when you're married. But I don't want to get into that now. Let's talk more about the dating. So when we date for so many hours and hours, we don't actually touch each other. Which, what that does is, that helps us get to know each other on a whole different level. Because when you're intimate with somebody, or when you're close with somebody physically, it doesn't allow you to get beyond that stage. You get stuck there. You don't really get to know each other. And you can't be objective either. Because you're so intimately connected on a physical level, that you can't pull back and actually talk about who we are as a people. And that's unique about our dating process. Now, what happens if you're dating and it doesn't work? This is a very important component. We're very secret about our dating. Why? What happens if Jake dates Sarah and they realize they're not a match? After a couple of times, they're not a match. So they say goodbye to each other and it's a mutual agreement. And then Jake may go ahead and marry someone else in the community who will ultimately find. So we don't talk about who we're dating. We keep it top secret. We don't date in the neighborhood, we date out of the neighborhood.
So like you go out and meet someone.
We meet someone outside of the community. You don't pull up in front of the house. It's quiet, far out. You know, the outskirts of the neighborhood. Sometimes you even take the subway and meet someone mutual out of the neighborhood and from there go in a car. And really it's about keeping it quiet because some people have to date 5-6 times within the same community. Now, not necessarily a community as in New York, my wife's from Michigan, but the same Chabad community, which is all over the world, but you know, you don't want to have to talk about it. Now, this system has its, you know, faults in a way, and I'm not going to negate that. But I could tell you from personal experience that it's very unique and very special. I have 8 siblings that are married. And in fact, my brother married a girl from 3 houses down the block. They never met each other. Because that's the society we grew up in. We always joke, you met one in the backyard. That's not what happened. They met through someone who introduced them. And they're happily married. Because they got to know each other on a whole different level. Now, this is unlike the misconception that we meet each other the day we get married. Some people think, oh, you probably met your wife the day you got married. The parents made the match, and then you met. The match was entirely up to us. The only difference is the legwork. A lot of that is done by our parents. Our parents are the ones that are very involved in the process. But once we start dating, the parents let go, and it's totally up to the 2 individuals involved what they want to do.
You said that because of concerns about what if it doesn't work out or something, you keep who you're dating very secret.
Right.
How do you manage to do that with so many people involved in the vetting process?
Everything is very, very quiet. It's very, like, even growing up, my parents never spoke about my brother's sibling or my sibling's dating in front of the kids. And the matchmakers were very, you know, they were people that were very respectful of the privacy. And there would no one ever talk about anybody or anything. There's another great benefit involved. If I was dating a girl and I'm not comfortable with certain things, I could have the matchmaker be a go-between. And the matchmaker could say things on my behalf. Or could find out things for me that I'm uncomfortable finding out. And this, again, helps you get the places further. Some people are married for 10 years and they don't really know each other. Just to mention, the divorce rate in our community is... There's definitely divorce, but it's minute. Statistics-wise, it's at a much smaller scale than the general society. I'm not advocating you try this out. But I would advocate that you could definitely take some of this... I'm not here, you know, to preach, but I could definitely tell you, throw me out the window in a minute. I just want to tell you, I can tell you, working with college kids for 4 years, that it's something unique when your relationship is based on getting to know each other. Each other's souls, each other's beings, rather than each other's bodies. It makes a big difference.
I want to ask you a question. I know you're running short on time. I had heard that when in the 50s, when they put the highways in New York and they cut up a lot of the neighborhoods. Do you know, did your grandparents or anyone talk about that, how that really disrupted a lot of neighborhoods?
I read about it, but not firsthand.
Oh, okay. It seemed like this person was a real terrible person that did it, was heralded in New York, but it just went everywhere. I wondered how
It's a very good question. I know the demographic has changed drastically. Like the community I grew up in the 1950s, wasn't a very Jewish neighborhood. It was actually Brownsville and other Canarsie, which now it's switched. Those areas are very different, populated much more by other communities. So there's been a lot of changes in the demographics, and probably as a result of this.
Did it seem like everyone still stuck together and found a way to...
Generally, communities move together.
I want to ask one more question before we let you go. I'm curious about finances. You come out here, I don't think you go get an 8-hour-a-day job. You wouldn't have time to do all the things you do that way. So how do you make it work financially? Does the larger Chabad community support you?
Our organization is funded by donors. Uh-huh. So part of my duty as the director of the local Chabad branch is to raise funds. So 100% of our budget comes from supporters, people that value the work that we do. So the short answer is no, there is no central funding. Everything is funded by alumni of the school, people who live in the area, parents of students, and other people that care for what we do.
Do you get decent support out of the Lawrence Jewish community?
Yeah, it's not enough, of course, a small community. Uh-huh. A lot of our support comes from all over the country. Uh-huh. People that are affiliated with the university at some level.
So there's a lot of generosity behind it.
It's got to be.
Yeah. Are there other ways to make money? I mean, you could conceivably run a Jewish school for non-Kabbalah children, or do kosher certifications. I can think of lots of things that would be compatible.
That's true, but
that's not...
I follow my passion. Huh. And part of the passion is making it happen. Huh. And that takes the hat that you hate wearing, which is the fundraiser. That's what you got to do as well. It also has the reason for that, because many other Jewish organizations are centrally funded, but our organization is not, because the impact is greater when it's funded locally. Any other questions before we wrap up?
Yeah.
Well, I just want to mention, I always say this at the end, that there's two, if you ever want to learn more about Judaism, we have a fascinating website, which is jewishku.com. It has over 20,000 pages of Jewish information. If you ever, in class, you have to look up something, you could definitely look it up. There's every topic you can imagine related to Judaism. And you can email rabbi@ku.edu. I'll be happy to help you out if there's any questions.
Sorry. Sure. Really good question before you wrap up. And this could go on for a while, so I'll just give you a brief answer. How is proselytism handled?
That's a good question. The only reason I'm questioning is because I forgot the afternoon prayer before the sun sets.
Oh,
so I have a couple minutes. The answer is that Judaism does not support conversion, meaning we don't solicit conversion. Supportive if someone wants to convert. Judaism is not about we have the truth and buy into it. Otherwise you're going to hell. Judaism is about every single person has a unique mission in life. And your mission is where you find yourself to be. So if I was born to a Hasidic family in Brooklyn, New York, and you were born, where are you from?
Wichita.
Yeah. Did you practice any religion growing up, specifically?
I was raised religious, yes.
Raised, okay. Which religion?
Lutheranism.
Okay, Lutheranism. Imagine I was born in Wichita. I was raised in Lutheranism, and you were born in Brooklyn, New York, in a Hasidic family. That would mean that that's our purpose in life. The reason why you were born in Wichita and I was born in Brooklyn, and we grew up with different religions, is because we have our own unique mission. So when someone comes and says, I want to convert, we are actually commanded in the Torah to say, no, what are you doing that for? Are you crazy? What are you missing? Yeah, go enjoy a cheeseburger. There's no reason why you shouldn't. We have different missions. Yeah, what I accomplish by not eating a cheeseburger, you accomplish by eating a cheeseburger. It's not better or worse, it's different. And that's why we don't solicit. And not only we don't solicit, if somebody comes and says, I want to convert, we brush them away 3 times. And if they still nag you, then you help them if you got it. But we very rarely do conversions.
That's actually what I was hinting at. Is the conversion traditionally a three three request model still. I mean, is that actually
implemented? Well, how did you do it today? It sounds like three emails. Is that three times?
if there were a proselyte who was earnest.
I think it's symbolism of how much you really want. Like, I'm involved with people that I get calls all the time. I want to convert. Sure, I come back, we meet, we talk for a few minutes. Okay, sure. Usually I just say, all right, this is what you got to do. 1, 2, 3, 4. Oh, okay, thank you so much, Rabbi. Nothing happens. But I, you know, very rarely there's a situation where somebody, and usually it's because of family, someone marries someone Jewish or the like. And then it's different because they have something pulling them in. They have a reason why they want to convert. And they're very serious about it. And that's when we serve as a support. But we don't proselytize. All right.
Well, if you need to get out, we better let you get out. Yeah, so thank you very much.
Sure. For the five.
Yep.
Next time we'll give some more time.
That's great.
But it's really a pleasure to be here again. I want to tell you all a personal note. One of the very first people I met when I moved to Lawrence, I think I was here for a week, was your dear professor. And he was very kind and generous at the time. He really eased my transition to the state of Kansas. And I consider him as a dear friend. And you also, I must say that out of the many, many people that teach in this wonderful university, it's a blessing to have him.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.